on the stretcher and being readied for the trip to the hospital. Both of her children were seated side by side on the sofa in the den. Ozzy was briefed by Tatum, then walked into the bedroom and saw Stuart. Dyer paused, glanced at Jake, and said, "Your Honor, at this time, the state would like to show the jury three photographs of the crime scene." Jake stood and said, "Your Honor, the defense will renew its objection to these photographs on the grounds that they are inflammatory, grossly prejudicial, and unnecessary." Noose said, "Your objection is noted. For the record, a timely objection was filed by the defense, and on July 16th, the court held a hearing on this matter. After being fully briefed, the court ruled that three of the photos are admissible. Your objection, Mr. Brigance, is overruled. As a word of caution to the jurors and the spectators, the photos are graphic. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you have no choice but to examine the photographs. As for anyone else, please use your own discretion. Proceed, Mr. Dyer." Regardless of how shocking and horrible they were, crime scene photos were rarely excluded in murder trials. Dyer handed a color 8x10 to Ozzy and said, "Sheriff Walls, this is State's Exhibit Number 2. Can you identify it?" Ozzy looked, grimaced, said, "This is a photo of Stuart Kofer, taken from the doorway of his bedroom." "And does it accurately portray what you saw?"
"Afraid so."
Ozzy lowered the photograph and looked away. Dyer said, "Your Honor, I'd like permission to hand the jurors three copies of the same photo and to put the image on the screen."
"Proceed."
Jake had objected to blasting the blood and gore on the big screen. Noose had overruled him. Suddenly, there was Stuart, lying across his bed, his feet hanging off the side, pistol beside his head, with a pool of dark red blood soaking the sheets and mattress. There were groans and gasps from the spectators. Jake stole a few glances at the jurors, several of whom looked away from the photos and the screen. Several others glared at Drew with pure contempt. The second photo was taken from a spot near Stuart's feet, a much closer view of his head and shattered skull, brains, lots of blood. A woman behind Jake was sobbing, and he knew it was Janet Kofer. Dyer took his time. He was playing his strongest hand and making the most of it. The third photo was a wider shot and clearly revealed the sprayed blood and matter across the pillows, headboard, and wall. Most of the jurors had seen enough and were preoccupied with their feet. The entire courtroom was stunned and felt as though it had been assaulted. Noose, sensing that everyone had seen enough, said,
"That'll do, Mr. Dyer. Please remove the image. And let's take a 15-minute break at this time. Please take the jurors to the jury room for a little recess."
He wrapped his gavel and disappeared. Portia had found only two cases in the last 50 years in which the Supreme Court had reversed a murder conviction because of gruesome and hideous crime scene photos. She had argued that Jake should object, but only for the record and not too strenuously. An overabundance of blood and gore might actually save their client on appeal. Jake, however, was not convinced. The damage was done, and the damage at that moment seemed insurmountable. Jake began the cross-examination of his former friend with, "Now, Sheriff Walls, does your department have a protocol for internal affairs?"
"Sure we do."
"And if a citizen has a complaint against one of your men, what do you do about it?"
"The complaint has to be in writing. I review it first and have a private conversation with the officer. Then we have a three-person review panel, one current deputy, two former ones. We take complaints seriously, Mr. Brigance. How many complaints were filed against Stuart Colfer during his time as your deputy? Zero. None. Were you aware of any problems he was having? I have had 14 deputies, Mr. Brigance. I can't get involved in all of their problems. Were you aware that Josie Gamble, Drew's mother, had called 911 on two prior occasions and asked for help? Well, I was not aware of it at the time. And why not? Because she did not press charges. Okay. When a deputy is dispatched after a 911 call to the scene of a domestic disturbance, does he file an incident report afterwards? Supposed to, yes. On February the 24th of this year, did Officers Pirtle and McCarver answer a 911 call at the Colfer residence? A call made by Josie Gamble, who told the dispatcher that Stuart Colfer was drunk and threatening her and her kids? Dyer jumped to his feet and said, "Objection, Your Honor. Calls for hearsay." Overruled. Continue. Sheriff Walls? Not sure about that. Well, I have the 911 recording. You want to hear it? I'll take your word for it. Thank you. And Josie Gamble will testify about it. I said I'd take your word for it. So, Sheriff, where is the incident report? Well, I'll have to go through the records. Jake walked to three large storage boxes stacked together beside the defense table. He pointed to them and said, "Here they are, Sheriff. I've got copies of all of the incident reports from your office for the past 12 months. And there's not one here filed by Officers Pirtle and McCarver for February 24th in response to a call by Josie Gamble." "Well, I guess it was misplaced. Keep in mind, Mr. Brigance, if no charges are filed by the complaining party, then it's really no big deal. Not much we can do. Oftentimes, we'll answer a domestic call, settle things down without taking any official action. The paperwork is not always that important." "I guess not. That's why it's missing." "Objection," Dyer said. "Sustained. Mr. Brigance, please refrain from testifying." "Yes, Your Honor. Now, Sheriff, on December the 3rd of last year, was Deputy Swayze dispatched to the same house after a 911 call from Josie Gamble? Another domestic disturbance?"
"You have the records, sir."
"But do you have the records? Where is the incident report filed by Deputy Swayze?"
"It's supposed to be in the file."
"But it's not." Dyer stood and said, "Objection, Your Honor. Does Mr. Brigance intend to introduce into evidence all of the records?" He waved at the boxes. Jake said, "Certainly, if necessary." Noose removed his reading glasses, rubbed his eyes, and asked, "Where are you going with this, Mr. Brigance?" The perfect opening. Jake said, "Your Honor, we will prove that there was a pattern of domestic abuse and violence perpetrated by Stuart Colfer against Josie Gamble and her children, and that it was covered up by the sheriff's office to protect one of its own." Dyer responded, "Your Honor, Mr. Colfer is not on trial, and he's not here to defend himself."
"I'll stop you at this time," Noose said. "I'm not sure if you've established the relevance."
"Fine, Judge," Jake said. "I'll just call the sheriff back to the stand during our defense. No further questions." Noose said,
"Sheriff Walls, you are excused, but you are still under subpoena, so you need to leave the courtroom after you get your gun."
Ozzie glared at Jake as he walked by.
"Mr. Dyer, please call your next witness."
"The state calls Captain Hollis Brazil of the Mississippi Highway Patrol." Brazil looked out of place in a sharp navy suit with a white shirt and red tie. He zipped through his qualifications and many years of experience, proudly informing the jury that he had investigated over 100 murders.
He talked about his arrival at the crime scene and wanted to dwell on the photos, but Noose, along with everyone else, had seen enough blood. Brazil described how his forensic team from the state crime lab pored over the scene, taking photographs and videos, collecting samples of blood and brain matter. The Glock's magazine held 15 bullets when fully loaded. Only one was missing, and they found it buried deep in the mattress near the headboard. Their tests matched it to the pistol. Dyer handed him a small plastic zip bag holding a bullet and explained that it was the one found in the mattress and it came from the pistol, and asked him to identify it. No doubt about it. Dyer then pressed a button and enlarged photos of the gun and bullet appeared. Brazil launched into a mini lecture about what happens when a bullet is fired. Primer and the powder explode within the cartridge, forcing the bullet down the barrel. The explosion produces gases that escape and land on the shooter's hands, and often his clothing. Gases and gunpowder particles follow the bullet and can provide evidence of the distance between the barrel and the entry wound. In this case, their tests revealed that the bullet traveled only a short distance. In Brazil's opinion, less than 2 inches. He was cocksure of his opinions, and the jurors listened intently. Jake, though, thought the testimony was dragging as it went on and on. He stole glances at the jurors, one of whom glanced around as if to say, all right, we get it. It's pretty obvious what happened. But Dyer plowed onward, trying to cover everything. Brazil said that after the body was removed, they took the sheets, 2 blankets, and 2 pillows. The investigation was routine and not complicated. The cause of death was obvious. The murder weapon was secure. A suspect had confessed to the murder to another credible witness. Later that Sunday morning, Brazil and 2 technicians went to the jail and fingerprinted the suspect. They also swabbed the suspect's hands, arms, and clothing to collect gunshot residue. Next was a symposium on fingerprints, with Brazil working through a series of slides and explaining that 4 latent prints were removed from the Glock and matched to partials taken from the defendant. Every person's prints are unique, and pointing to a thumbprint with tinted arches, he said there was no doubt the 4 prints, 3 fingers and 1 thumb, were left on the gun by the defendant. Next was a windy technical analysis of chemical tests used to find and measure GSR, gunshot residue. No one was surprised when Brazil finally reached the conclusion that Drew had fired the weapon. When Dyer tendered the witness at 11:50, Jake stood, shrugged, and said, "The defense has no question, John." Noose, along with everyone else, needed a break. He looked at a bailiff and said, "We'll be in recess. Is the lunch prepared for the jurors?" The bailiff nodded. "Okay. We're in recess until 1:30. Chapter 44. When the courtroom was empty, Drew sat alone at the table, twiddling his thumbs under the languid gaze of a crippled bailiff. Moss Jr. and Mr. Zack appeared and said it was time for lunch. They led him through a side door up a rickety set of ancient stairs to a 3rd-floor room that had once housed the county law library. It, too, had seen its better days and gave the impression that legal research was not a priority in Van Buren County. Shelves of dusty books sat at odd angles, with some leaning precariously, much like the courthouse itself. In an open area, there was a card table with 2 folding chairs. "Over there," Moss Jr. said, pointing, and Drew took a seat. Mr. Zack produced a brown bag and a bottle of water. Drew removed a sandwich wrapped in foil and a bag of chips. Moss Jr. said to Mr. Zack,
He should be safe here. I'll be downstairs.
He left, and they listened as he lumbered down the stairs. Mr. Zack sat across from Drew and asked,
"What do you think of your trial so far?"
Drew shrugged. Jake had lectured him about talking to anyone in a uniform.
"Things don't look so good."
Mr. Zack grunted and smiled.
"You can say that again."
"What's weird is how they make Stuart out to be such a nice guy."
"He was a nice guy."
"Yeah, to you. It was a different story living with him."
"You gonna eat?"
"Not hungry."
"Come on, Drew. You barely touched your breakfast. You gotta eat something."
"You know, you've been saying that ever since I met you."
Mr. Zack opened his own bag and took a bite from a turkey sandwich. Drew asked,
"You bring any cards?"
"I did."
"Great. Blackjack?"
"Sure. After you eat."
"You owe me $1.30, right?"
2 miles away in downtown Chester, the defense team ate sandwiches in Morris Finley's conference room. Morris, a busy lawyer himself, was away tending to matters in federal court. He didn't have the luxury of spending entire days watching another lawyer's trial. Nor did Harry Rex, whose stressful office was being completely ignored by the only lawyer in his firm. But he wouldn't miss the Gamble trial for anything. He, Lucian, Portia, Libby, Jake, and Carla ate quickly and went through the state's case so far. The only surprise had been Noose's refusal to allow Brazil to revisit the ghastly crime scene photos. Ozzie had done a passable job, though he had looked bad trying to cover for the missing paperwork. It was a small win for the defense, but one that would be forgotten soon enough. The fact that county deputies were not exactly thorough with their mundane reports would not be important when the jury debated guilt or innocence. Overall, the morning had been a huge win for the state, but that was no surprise. The case was simple, straightforward, and had no missing clues. Dyer's opening was effective and captured the attention of every juror. Taking one name at a time, they talked about all 12. The first 6 men were convinced and ready to vote guilty. Joey Kepner had revealed nothing in his facial expressions and body language. The 5 women did not appear to be any more sympathetic. Most of their lunch was consumed with Kira. Dyer had proven that Drew had committed the murder beyond a reasonable doubt. The state didn't need Kira as a witness to bolster its case. Her statement to Tatum that Drew shot Stuart was already in evidence.
"But he's a prosecutor," Lucian argued. "And as a breed, they're known to pile on. She's the only person who can testify that she heard the gunshot and heard her brother admit to the shooting. Of course, Drew could admit this himself, but only if he takes the stand. Josie was there, but unconscious. If Dyer doesn't call Kira to the stand, the jurors will wonder why not. And what about the appeal? What if the Supremes rule that Tatum's testimony should have been excluded as hearsay? It'll be a close call, right?"
"Maybe. Maybe not," Jake said.
"Okay, let's say we win on hearsay. Dyer might be worried about that, and he might be thinking he needs to double down and get the girl to testify to it."
"Do they really need it?" Libby asked. "Isn't there an abundance of physical evidence already in the record?"
"It sure feels like it," Jake said. Harry Rex said,
"Dyer's a dumbass if he puts on. Plain and simple, he's got his case made. Why not just rest and wait on the defense?"
Jake said, "He'll put her on, get her statement, then fight like hell when we start with the abuse."
"But the abuse is coming in, right?"
Libby asked.
"There's no way to keep it out."
"It'll be up to Noose," Jake said. "He has our brief, and we've argued convincingly, at least in my opinion, that the abuse is relevant. To keep it out will be reversible error."
Are we trying to win the trial or the appeal?
Carla asked.
Both.
And so they debated as they ate bad deli sandwiches to ward off hunger. The state's next witness was Dr. Ed Majeski, the pathologist hired to perform the autopsy. Dyer led him through the usual list of dry questions to establish his expertise and made much of the fact he had performed over a 30-year career 2,000 autopsies, including approximately 300 involving gunshot wounds. When offered the opportunity to question his credentials, Jake declined and said, "Yana, we accept Dr. Majeski's qualifications." Dyer then approached the bench with Jake and whispered to the judge that the state would like to introduce 4 photos taken during the autopsy. This was no surprise, because Dyer had produced the photos in a pretrial hearing. Noose, as usual, deferred a ruling until that moment. He looked at the photos again, shook his head, and said, away from the mic, "I don't think so. This jury has seen enough of the blood and gore. The defense's objection is sustained." It was obvious that His Honor was troubled by the crime scene photos and their gruesomeness. Dyer switched to a rather cartoonish diagram of a generic corpse and put it on the screen. For an hour, Dr. Majeski belabored the obvious. Using far too many medical terms and jargon, he bored the courtroom with testimony that proved beyond any doubt that the deceased died of a single bullet wound to the head, one that blew away most of the right side of his skull. As he droned on, Jake couldn't help but think of Earl and Janet Kofer, seated not far away, and their pain at hearing such details about their son's fatal injury. And as always when he thought of the parents, he reminded himself that he was fighting to keep a kid away from the gas chamber. Now was not the time for sympathy. When Dyer mercifully tendered the witness, Jake jumped to his feet and stepped to the podium. "Dr. Majeski, did you draw a sample of blood from the deceased?"
"Of course. That is standard practice."
"And did this sample reveal anything significant?"
"Such as?"
"Such as the level of alcohol in his system."
"It did."
"Now, for the benefit of the jury, and for me as well, could you please explain how one's alcohol level is measured?"
"Certainly. The blood alcohol concentration, better known as BAC, is the amount of alcohol in the bloodstream, or in urine, or on one's breath. It is expressed as the weight of ethanol, or alcohol, in grams, the metric unit, in 100 milliliters of blood."
"Let's keep it simple, Doctor. The legal limit for drunk driving in Mississippi is 0.10 BAC. What does that mean?"
"Sure. It means 0.10 grams of alcohol per 100 milliliters of blood."
"Okay, thank you. Now, what was Stuart Kofer's BAC?
"It was quite significant. 0.36 grams per 100.
0.36?
"That's correct.
So the deceased was 3.5 times over the legal limit for driving."
"Yes, sir."
Juror number 4, a white man of 55, glanced at juror number 5, a white man of 58. Juror number 8, a white woman, appeared shocked. Joey Kepner shook his head slightly in disbelief. "Now, Dr. Majeski, for how long had Mr. Kofer been dead before you drew a sample of his blood?"
"Approximately 12 hours.
"And is it possible that during that 12-hour period, the alcohol level could have actually decreased?"
"Unlikely, but it's possible." "That's unlikely, but no one really knows. It's rather hard to measure for obvious reasons."
"Okay. Let's stick with 0.36. Did you weigh the body?"
"I did, as always. That's standard procedure."
And how much did he weigh?
197 pounds.
He was 33 years old and weighed 197, right?
Correct. But his age should not be factored in.
Okay, let's forget his age. For a man his size and with that much alcohol, how would you describe his ability to operate a vehicle?
Dyer stood and said, "Objection, Your Honor. This goes beyond the scope of his testimony. I'm not sure this expert is qualified to give such an opinion."
His Honor looked down at the witness and asked,
"Dr. Majeski, are you qualified for this?"
He smiled with arrogance and said,
"Yes, I am."
Objection overruled. You may answer the question.
"Well, Mr. Brigance, I certainly wouldn't want to be in the car with him."
This drew a few brief smiles from some of the jurors. "Nor would I, Doctor." "Would you describe him as being completely impaired?"
"That would be a non-medical term, but yes."
"And what are the other effects of so much alcohol, sir, in non-medical terms?"
"Devastating. Loss of physical coordination, greatly reduced reflexes, walking or even standing would require assistance, slurred or indistinguishable speech, nausea, vomiting, disorientation, severe increases in heart rate, irregular breathing, loss of bladder control, memory loss, perhaps even unconsciousness."
Jake flipped a page on his legal pad to allow these frightening effects to rattle around the courtroom. Then he stepped to the defense table and picked up some papers. Slowly he returned to the podium and said, "Now, Dr. Majeski, you said you've performed over 2,000 autopsies in your distinguished career."
"That's correct."
"How many of those deaths were caused by alcohol poisoning?"
Dyer stood again and said, "Objection, Your Honor, on the grounds of relevance. We're not concerned here with the death of anyone else."
"Mr. Brigance, Your Honor, this is a cross-examination, and I'm given wide latitude. The drunkenness of the deceased is certainly relevant."
"I'll allow for now, but let's see where it's going. You may answer the question, Dr. Majeski."
The witness shifted his weight, but was obviously enjoying the chance to discuss his experience and knowledge.
"I'm not sure exactly, but there have been several.
Last year, you did the autopsy for a fraternity boy down in Gulfport. Last name of Cooney. Do you remember that one?"
"I do, yes. Very sad."
Jake glanced at his paperwork. "You concluded that the cause of death was AAP, acute alcohol poisoning, correct?"
"Correct."
"Do you remember the kid's BAC?"
"No, I'm sorry."
"I have your report right here. Would you like to see it?"
"No, just refresh my memory, Mr. Brigance."
Jake lowered the papers, looked at the jury, and said, .33.
"That sounds accurate," Dr. Majeski said.
Jake returned to his table, shuffled some papers, withdrew a few, and returned to the podium. "Do you recall an autopsy you performed in August of 1987 on a Meridian fireman named Pellegrini?" Dyer stood with stretched arms and said, "Your Honor, please, I object to this line of questioning on the grounds of relevance."
"Overruled. You may answer the question."
Dyer fell hard into his chair, and his theatrics drew a harsh look from the bench. Dr. Majeski said,
"Yes, I remember that one."
Jake scanned the top sheet, though all the details were memorized. "Says here he was 44 years old and weighed 192 pounds. His body was found in the basement of his home. You concluded that the cause of death was AAP. Does this sound right, Doctor?"
"Yes, it does."
"Do you happen to recall his BAC?"
"Not exactly, no."
Again, Jake lowered the papers, looked at the jury, and announced, .32. He glanced at Joey Kepner and saw the faint beginnings of a smile. Dr. Majewski, is it safe to say that Stuart Kofor was near death from his alcohol consumption? Dyer bounced up again and angrily said, "Objection, Your Honor! This calls for an opinion that is far too speculative."
"It does indeed." "Objection sustained."
After a perfect buildup, Jake was ready for the punchline. He stepped toward his table, stopped, looked at the witness, and asked, "Isn't it possible, Dr. Majewski, that Stuart Kofor was already dead when he got shot?" Dyer yelled, "Objection, Your Honor!"
"Sustained."
"Don't answer that." "Nothing further," Jake said as he glanced at the spectators. Harry Rex was grinning. On the back row, Lucian beamed at his protege and could not have been prouder. Most of the jurors appeared to be stunned. It was almost 3, and His Honor needed another round of meds. He said,
"Let's take the afternoon recess and get some coffee. I'd like to see the lawyers in chambers."
Lowell Dyer was still fuming when they gathered around the table. Noose had disrobed and was lining up little bottles of pills as he stretched at his desk. He gulped them down with a cup of water and took a seat at the table. He smiled and said,
"Well, gentlemen, with no insanity to fight over, this trial is moving right along. My compliments to both of you."
He looked at the prosecutor and asked,
"Who's your next witness?"
Dyer tried to shrug it off and appear as cool as his opponent. He took a deep breath and said,
"I don't know, Judge. I plan to call Kira Gamble to the stand, but right now, I'm somewhat reluctant."
"Why?"
"Because we'll get into the abuse. As I've said before, it's simply not fair to allow these people to testify to matters that I cannot effectively rebut on cross-examination. It's not fair to allow them to slander Stuart Kofor."
"Slander?" Jake asked.
"Slander implies false testimony, Lowell. But we don't know what's false and what's true."
"They'll be under oath," Noose said.
"True, but they'll also have every reason to exaggerate the abuse. There is no one to rebut it."
Jake said, "The facts are the facts, Lowell. We can't change them. The truth is that these three were living in a nightmare because they were abused and threatened, and the abuse was a major factor in the killing."
"So it was for retribution."
"I didn't say that."
"Gentlemen, we've been discussing this for some time, and I have been briefed by both sides. I am persuaded that the case law in this state leans toward the exploration of the reputation of the deceased, especially in a factual setting like this. Therefore, I will allow it to a point. If I believe that the witnesses are exaggerating, as you say, Mr. Dyer, then you can always object and we'll revisit the issue. We'll take it slow. We have plenty of time and there is no hurry."
"Then the state rests, Your Honor. We've proven our case beyond a reasonable doubt. The intoxication of the deceased does not alter the fact that he was murdered by Drew Gamble, whether on duty or not."
Jake mumbled, "What a ridiculous law."
"It's on the books, Jake. We can't change it."
"Gentlemen,"
Noose grimaced in pain and tried to stretch,
"it's going on 4:00. I have an appointment with a physical therapist at 5:30. I'm not whining, but my lower lumbar needs some work. It is difficult to sit for more than 2 or 3 hours at a time. Let's dismiss the jury, take an early recess, and reconvene in the morning at 9:00.
Jake was pleased. The jurors would go home with Kofor's blackout drinking fresh on their minds. Chapter 45. Dinner at Jake's office was another round of sandwiches, though far tastier. Carla rushed home from the trial, gathered Hannah, and together they grilled chicken and put together gourmet-style paninis. They delivered them to the office and ate with Libby, Josie, and Kira. Portia was at home checking on her mother and would rejoin the team for another late session. Harry Rex was at his office putting out fires while Lucian begged off and needed a drink. As they ate, they replayed the day's events, from the prosecutor's opening statement through all the testimony. As upcoming witnesses, Josie and Kira were still banned from the courtroom and were eager to hear what had transpired. Jake assured them that Drew was holding up just fine and being taken care of. They worried about his safety, but Jake said he was well guarded. The courtroom was full of Kofers and their friends, and it was undoubtedly a painful spectacle for them to endure. But so far, no one had misbehaved. They talked about the jurors as if they were old friends. Libby thought number 7, Mrs. Fife, was particularly disgusted by Kofers' drinking. Number 2, Mr. Poole, a deacon in the First Baptist Church and strict teetotaler, seemed bothered by it too. Jake said, "Wait till they hear the rest of the story. The drinking will seem like child's play." They covered all 12. Carla didn't like number 11, Miss Twitchell, age 24, the youngest and the only one not married. She had a sneer that never went away, and she continually glared at Drew. At 8, Hannah was bored with whatever the adults were doing in the big room and wanted to go home. Carla left to put her to bed. Despite the boredom, she was thoroughly enjoying the trial itself because the long days were being spent with Jake's parents. Portia returned and went to the library for some research. Jake said, "Okay, Josie, you're the first one up tomorrow. We're going to talk through your testimony again, word for word. Libby will play the role of the prosecutor and fire away whenever she wants." "Again?" Josie asked, already tired. "Yes, again and again. And Kira, you're next. Keep in mind, Josie, that after you testify, you will be released and you can stay in the courtroom. Kira will be called next. So I want you to listen and observe everything she says and does as we go through it again."
"Got it. Let's have it."
Another storm at daybreak knocked out the electricity. An automatic generator in the courthouse failed to kick on, and by 7:30, the elderly janitorial crew was scrambling to fix the problems. When Judge News arrived at 8:15, the lights were at least flickering, a hopeful sign. He called the power company and raised hell, and half an hour later, the lights came on for good. The window unit sputtered to life and began straining to combat the thick humidity in the courtroom. When he assumed the bench at 9 o'clock, his robe was already wet around the collar.
"Good morning," he said loudly into his mic, which was working at full volume. "Seems as though we lost power in the storm a few hours ago. It has been restored, but I'm afraid the heat will be with us for a few hours."
Jake cursed him for selecting that badly designed and dilapidated old building for a trial in August, but only in passing. He had more important matters on his mind.
"Bring in the jury," News said.
They filed in, dressed for the day in short-sleeve shirts and cotton dresses. As they took their seats, a bailiff handed each a funeral fan, a decorative piece of cardboard glued to a stick, as if flapping it back and forth in front of their noses would bring relief from the stifling heat. Many of the spectators were already waving them.
News said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I apologize for the loss of power and the heat, but the show must go on. I will allow the attorneys to remove their jackets, but keep the ties, please. Mr. Brigance."
Jake stood and smiled as he turned the podium to face the jury. With his jacket still on, he began with, "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm allowed at this time to to make a few remarks about what I hope to prove in the defense of Drew Gamble. Now, I am not going to risk losing credibility with you by suggesting that there might be questions about who shot Stuart Kofer. It's pretty clear. Mr. Lowell Dyer, our fine district attorney, did a masterful job yesterday proving the state's case. Now it's up to the defense to tell you the rest of the story. And there is so much more to the story. What we will attempt to do is describe the nightmare that Josie Gamble and her two children were living. With a clenched fist, he tapped the podium in rhythm as he said, "It was a living hell." He paused for a second, then tapped out, "They are lucky to be alive." A little too dramatic, Harry Rex thought. Not nearly loud enough, Lucian said to himself. About a year ago, Josie and Stuart met in a bar, which was fitting for both of them. Josie had spent plenty of time in bars and honky-tonks, as had Stuart, and it should be no surprise that that's where they met. Josie told him she lived in Memphis and was visiting a friend, one who did not happen to be in the bar. She was alone. It was a lie. Josie and her two children were living in a borrowed camper on the property of a distant relative who had told them to leave. They had no place to go. A romance of sorts quickly ensued, with Josie in hot pursuit once she learned that Stuart owned his own home. And he was a deputy in Ford County, a man with a good paycheck. She's a cute girl. Likes tight jeans and other clothing that might be considered suggestive. And Stuart was smitten. You'll meet her in a minute. She's our first witness, the mother of the defendant. With Josie pushing hard, Stuart invited her to move in. He didn't want her kids because, by his own admission, he wasn't cut out for fatherhood. But it was a package deal. For the first time in 2 years, the Gambles had a real roof over their heads. For about a month, things were okay. Tense, but survivable. Then Stuart began complaining about how much the arrangement was costing him. The kids ate too much, he said. Josie was working two jobs at minimum wage, that's all she ever earned, and trying her best to support the family. Then the beatings started, and violence became a way of life. Now, you've heard a lot about Stuart and what kind of person he was when sober. Mercifully, that was most of the time. He never missed a day of work, never showed up drunk. Sheriff Wall said he was a good deputy and really enjoyed law enforcement when he wasn't drinking. But once on the bottle, he became a vile, vicious, violent man. He loved the honky-tonks, the nightlife, hard drinking with his buddies, and he was a brawler. Loved a good fist fight, liked to shoot dice. Almost every Friday and Saturday night after work, he hit the bars and would come home drunk. Sometimes he was aggressive and looking for trouble. Other times, he just went to bed and passed out. Josie and her kids learned to leave him alone and hide in their rooms, praying there would be no trouble. But there was trouble, and plenty of it. The kids begged their mother to leave, but there was no place to go, nowhere to run. As the violence grew worse, she begged him to get help, to cut back on the drinking, and to stop hitting them. But Stuart was out of control. She threatened to leave him on several occasions, and this always sent him into a rage. He called her names, cursed her in front of the kids, made fun of her because she had nowhere to go, called her trailer park trash. Dyer stood and said, "Your Honor, I object on the grounds of hearsay." Sustained. Jurors number 3 and 9 lived in trailers. Jake ignored Dyer and Noose and concentrated on the faces of 3 and 9. He continued, "On Saturday night, March 24, Stuart was out. In fact, he'd been gone all afternoon, and Josie was expecting the worst. They waited as the hours passed. Midnight came and went. The kids were upstairs in Kira's room with the lights off, hiding, hoping their mother wouldn't get hurt again. They were in Kira's room because her door was sturdier and the lock worked better. They knew this from experience. The previous door had been kicked in by Stuart during one of his rages. Josie was downstairs, waiting for the headlights to appear in the driveway. He paused for a long time, then said, "You know, I'll let them tell the story." He stepped behind the podium, glanced at his notes, and wiped sweat from his forehead. But for the funeral fans and the constant hum of the window units, the courtroom was silent and still. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not a clear-cut case of premeditated murder. Far from it. We will prove that during that horrifying moment, with his mother unconscious on the kitchen floor, with Stuart blind drunk and stomping through the house, with his sister crying and begging their mother to wake up, with both children alone and vulnerable, with the history of indescribable violence scarred into their frightened souls, with the belief that they were not safe and would never be safe from that man. What little Drew Gamble did was entirely justified. Jake nodded at the jurors and turned to face the judge. "Yana, we are ready with our first witness, Josie Gamble." "Very well. Please call her to the stand." No one moved as Josie made her entrance. Jake met her at the railing, opened the low gate of the bar, and pointed to the witness stand. Because she had been superbly coached, she stopped by the court reporter, offered her a smile, and swore to tell the truth. For the occasion, she wore a simple sleeveless white blouse tucked into a pair of black linen slacks and brown flat sandals. Nothing was tight or revealing. Her short blonde hair was pulled back. No lipstick, little makeup. Carla was in charge of her appearance, and after studying the five female jurors, she had loaned her the blouse and sandals and bought the slacks. The goal was to appear attractive enough to please the seven men, but simple enough not to threaten the women. Her 32 years had been hard, and she looked at least 10 years older. Still, she was younger than most of the jurors and in better shape than virtually all of them. Jake began with some basic questions, and in doing so, elicited her current address, which until then was unknown. The bill collectors had not found her in Oxford, and he had debated which address to use. Without too much detail, they went through her past. Two pregnancies before she was 17, no high school diploma, two bad marriages, the first conviction for possessing drugs at the age of 23, a year in the county jail, the second drug conviction in Texas that landed her in prison for 2 years. She owned her past, said she was not proud of it, and would give anything if she could go back and change things. She was at once stoic and vulnerable. She managed to smile at the jurors a time or two without making light of the situation. Her biggest regret was what she had done to her children, the lousy example she had set. Her voice cracked slightly when she talked about them, and she wiped her eyes with a tissue. Though every question and answer was thoroughly scripted, the conversation seemed genuine. Her story unfolded with ease at times and with pain at other times. Jake held a legal pad as if he needed a prompt, but every word had been committed to memory and rehearsed. Libby and Portia could recite the exchange verbatim. Switching gears, Jake said, "Now, Josie, on December 3rd of last year,
you made a 911 call to the county dispatcher. What happened?
Dyer stood and said, "Objection, Your Honor. Why is this relevant to the murder on March the 25th?
Mr. Brigance?
Your Honor, this 911 call is already before the jury. Sheriff Walls testified about it yesterday. It's relevant because it goes to the abuse, violence, and fear these people were living with leading up to the events of March 25th.
Overruled. Mr. Brigance.
Jake said, "Josie, tell us what happened on December the 3rd. She hesitated and took a deep breath, as if dreading the recall of another bad night.
"It was a Saturday around midnight, and Stuart came home in a foul mood. Very drunk, as usual. I was wearing jeans and a t-shirt, no bra, and he began accusing me of sleeping around. This happened all the time. He liked to call me a slut and a whore, even in front of my children."
Dyer jumped up again and said, "Objection! This is hearsay, Your Honor." Judge New said, "Sustained," and looked down at the witness. "Ms. Gamble, I'll ask you not to repeat specific statements made by the deceased."
"Yes, sir."
It happened just the way Jake said it would, but her words would not be forgotten by the jurors.
"You may continue."
She said,
"Anyway, he flew into a rage and slapped me across the mouth, busted my lip, and there was blood. He grabbed me, and I tried to fight him, but he was so strong and angry. I told him that if he hit me again, I was leaving, which made matters worse. I managed to get away and ran to the bedroom, locked the door. I thought he was going to kill me. I called 911 and asked for help. I cleaned up my face and sat on the bed for a while. The kids were upstairs hiding in their bedrooms. I listened to see if he was bothering them. After a few minutes, I came out, went to the den. He was in his recliner, a chair we couldn't touch, drinking a beer and watching television. I told him the cops were on the way, and he laughed at me. He knew they wouldn't do anything because he knew them all. They were his buddies. He told me that if I pressed charges, he would kill me and the kids."
"Did the police arrive?"
"Yes. Deputy Swayze came out. By then, Stuart had settled down, and he did a good job of faking it. Said everything was okay, just a little domestic spat. The deputy looked at my face. My cheek and lips were swollen, and he noticed some blood at the corner of my mouth. He knew the truth. He asked me if I wanted to press charges, and I said no. They left the house together, went outside, smoked a cigarette, just a couple of old friends. I went upstairs and spent the night with the kids in Kira's room. He didn't come after us."
She dabbed her eyes with the tissue and looked at Jake, ready to proceed. He said, "On February the 24th of this year, you called 911 again. What happened?"
Dyer stood and objected. Noose glared at him and said, "Overruled. Continue."
"It was a Saturday, and that afternoon a preacher, Brother Charles McGarry, had stopped by the house, just paying a call, you know. We had been visiting his church down the road, and Stuart didn't like it. When the preacher knocked on the door, Stuart got a beer and went into the backyard somewhere. He didn't go out that night for some reason, just hung around the house watching basketball games and drinking. I sat with him and tried to have a chat, you know. I asked him if he wanted to go to church with us the next day. He did not. He didn't like church and didn't like preachers and told me that McGarry was not welcome ever again in his house. It was always his house, never our house."
Charles and Meg McGarry sat two rows behind the defense table, waiting for Josie to join them. "Why did you call 911? Jake asked. She patted her forehead with the tissue.
"Well, we started arguing about the church, and he told me I couldn't go back there. I said I'd go any time I wanted. He was yelling, and I wasn't backing down, and suddenly he threw a can of beer at me. It hit me in the eye and cut my eyebrow. I was covered in beer, and I ran to the bathroom and saw the blood. He was banging on the door, cussing like crazy, calling me all the usual names. I was afraid to come out, and I just knew he was about to kick in the door. He finally quit and left, and I heard him in the kitchen. So I ran to the bedroom, locked the door, and called 911. It was a mistake, because I knew the police wouldn't bother him. But I was scared to death and wanted to protect the kids. He heard me on the phone and started banging on the bedroom door. Said he would kill me if the cops showed up. After a few minutes, he settled down and said he wanted to talk. I didn't want to talk, but I knew if he blew up again, he might hurt me or the kids. So I came out, went to the den where he was sitting, and for the first and only time, he said he was sorry. He begged me to forgive him and promised to get some help with his drinking. He seemed sincere, but he was only worried about the 911 call.
Had you been drinking, Josie?
No. I have a beer every now and then, but never in front of my kids. I really can't afford to drink.
When did the police arrive?
Around 10. When I saw the headlights, I went outside to meet them. I said I was okay. Things had settled down. It was just a misunderstanding. I was holding a bloody rag over my eye, and they asked what happened. I said I fell in the kitchen, and they seemed eager to believe this.
Did they talk to Stuart?
Yes. He came outside, and I went in. I could hear them laughing as they smoked a cigarette.
And you didn't press charges?
No.
Jake walked to the defense table and took off his jacket. His armpits were soaked with sweat, and the back of his light blue Oxford cloth was stuck to his skin. He returned to the podium and said, "What efforts did Stuart take to control his drinking?"
"None whatsoever. It just got worse."
On the night of March 25th, were you at home with your children?
Yes.
Where was Stuart?
Out. I don't know where he was. He'd been gone all afternoon.
What time did he come home?
It was after 2 in the morning. I was waiting. The kids were upstairs, supposedly asleep, but I could hear them moving around quietly. I guess all of us were waiting.
What happened when he got home?
Well, I put on a little negligee, one that he liked, thinking, you know, that maybe I could get him in the mood for a little romance, anything to prevent more violence.
How'd that work out?
It didn't. He was blind drunk, had trouble walking and standing up. His eyes were glazed over. His breathing was very heavy. I'd seen him plenty drunk, but nothing like that.
What happened?
He saw what I was wearing and didn't like it. He started his accusations. I didn't want another fight because of the kids. God, they hurt so much.
Her voice cracked, and she broke down. Her sobbing was unscripted, but real and perfectly timed. She closed her eyes and covered her mouth with the tissue as she fought the tears. Libby noticed number 7, Mrs. Fife, drop her head and clench her jaws, seemingly ready to shed a sympathetic tear. After a painful, silent moment, Judge Noose leaned over and said softly, "Would you like to take a break, Miss Gamble?" She shook her head firmly, gritted her teeth, and looked at Jake. He said, "Josie, I know this is not easy, but you have to tell the jury what happened." She nodded rapidly and said,
"He slapped me hard across the face, and I almost fell down. Then he grabbed me from behind, had his thick forearm around my neck, and was choking me. I knew it was the end, and all I could think about was my kids. Who would raise them? Where would they go? Would he hurt them, too? It all happened so fast. He was growling, cussing, and I could smell his awful breath. I managed to elbow him in the ribs and tear myself away. Before I could run, he hit me hard with his fist. That's the last thing I remember. He knocked me unconscious.
You don't remember anything else?
Nothing. When I woke up, I was in the hospital.
Jake stepped to the defense table, where Libby handed him an enlarged color photo.
Yana, I'd like to approach the witness.
Proceed. Jake handed the photo to Josie and asked her, can you identify this photograph?
Yes. It was taken of me the following day in the hospital.
Yana, I'd like to enter into the record this photo as defense exhibit number one. Lowell Dyer, who had copies of 8 photos taken of Josie, rose and said, the state objects on the grounds of relevancy. Overruled. It is admitted into evidence. Jake said, Yana, I'd like the jury to see this evidence.
Proceed.
Jake took the remote, pressed a button, and the startling image of a battered woman splashed onto the wide screen on the wall opposite the jurors. Everyone in the courtroom could see it. Josie in the hospital bed, the left side of her face swollen grotesquely, her left eye shut, thick gauze covering her chin and wrapped around her head. A tube ran into her mouth. Others hung from above. Her face was unrecognizable. Every juror reacted. Some shifted uncomfortably. Some leaned forward as if a few inches would provide a better look at what was perfectly clear. Number 5, Mr. Carpenter, shook his head. Number 8, Mrs. Satterfield, stared open-mouthed as if in disbelief. Harry Rex would later say that Janet Kofer dropped her head. Jake asked, do you know what time you woke up?
Around 8 that morning, they said. I was on painkillers and other stuff and pretty groggy.
How long were you in the hospital?
That was Sunday. On Wednesday, they moved me to the hospital in Tupelo for surgery to reset my jaw. It was shattered. I was released on Friday.
And did you make a full recovery from your injuries? She nodded and said,
I'm fine.
Jake had other photos of Josie in the hospital, but at that moment, they were not needed. He had other questions, but Lucian had taught him years ago to quit when you're ahead. When you've driven home your points, leave something to the imagination of the jurors. He said,
I tender the witness.
Noose said, let's take a break. 15-minute recess. Lowell Dyer and his assistant Musgrove huddled in a first-floor restroom and tried to decide what to do next. Normally, a convicted felon was easy to cross-examine because his or her credibility was questionable. But Josie had already talked about her convictions and some of her other problems as well. She was forthcoming, credible, sympathetic, and the jury would never forget the image of her in the hospital. They agreed that they had no choice but to attack from some angle. When Josie retook the stand, Dyer began with, Ms. Gamble, how many times have you lost custody of your children?
Twice.
What was the first time?
Approximately 10 years ago. Drew was around 5 or so. Kira was 3.
And why did you lose custody?
They were taken away by the state of Louisiana.
And why did this happen?
Well, Mr. Dyer, I was not a very good mother back then. I was married to a small-time drug dealer who peddled his goods out of our apartment. Someone complained, and social services came in, got him, and took me to court.
Were you selling drugs, too?
Yes, I was. I'm not proud of it. I wish I could do many things over, Mr. Dyer.
What happened to your kids?
They were placed in foster care. In good homes, I got to see them occasionally. I split up with the guy, got a divorce, and managed to get my kids back.
What happened the second time?
I was living with a house painter who also sold drugs. He got caught and plea bargained his way out by telling the authorities that the drugs belonged to me. A bad lawyer convinced me to plead to a lesser sentence, and I got sent away to a women's prison in Texas. Served 2 years. Drew and Kira were placed in a Baptist orphanage in Arkansas and were treated very well.
Don't volunteer too much, Jake had warned her repeatedly. At the moment, she felt as though she knew every question Dyer might throw at her.
Do you still use drugs? No, sir, I don't. I quit years ago for the sake of my kids.
Did you ever sell drugs?
Yes.
So you admit that you've used drugs, sold drugs, lived with drug dealers, been arrested?
How many times? Four.
Arrested four times, convicted twice, and served time in prison.
I'm not proud of any of that, Mr. Dyer. Who
would be? And you expect this jury to believe in your credibility as a witness and believe all of your testimony?
Are you calling me a liar, Mr. Dyer?
I'll ask the questions, Ms. Gamble. Your job is to answer them.
Yes. I expect the jury to believe every word I've said because it's all true. I may have lied before, but I assure you that lying was the least of my sins.
The smart move would be to stop the bleeding. She was scoring far more points than the prosecutor. Brigance had her prepped to the max, and she was ready for anything. Dyer